Action Park Media.
So you guys are in for a treat. I am joined today by Rebecca, who you probably know from Instagram. Her Instagram is Journey to Wellness, and she blew up kind of during COVID and when everyone was like so thoroughly enjoying her beautiful animations with her mental health help in there. She's written a brand new book. It's fantastic. But today we dive into sort of high functioning anxiety, the desire to find moments of calm and people pleasing, and some practical tips too. So here you go. It is Pretty Depressed with Rebecca. Honestly, Rebecca, I feel like you've come into my life at exactly the perfect time, which you probably might have more to chat about later. But yeah, it's so nice to have you with me. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. Seriously, it's an honor to be here. I'm chuffed.
Oh, great. And are you sitting on the floor? Because I think this is, of course you are. Of course you are, right?
I'm always on the floor.
I love that. I love that so much. That's perfect. Well, I'm sitting here with two cats. You know what? The first place that I wanted to start was sort of how you got into this space, because, and maybe you can speak a little to, I'm assuming that your journey maybe came from a personal journey and share as much as you want, but just some of the stuff that you're posting online is resonating so much with people, because I think you're tapping into something really beautiful, which is finding that calm, which I think we were all chasing happiness in the early 2000s. And now I think we're chasing calm. But yeah, how did you end up into this place and building such a massive community?
So I guess there's kind of two tracks. Like, yes, one is how did I end up with Journey to Wellness, the business, but how I ended up working in mental health was exactly as you said. It started with my own journey and experience. So growing up, I sometimes say that I kind of feel like I was marinated in an environment of mental health issues and things like that. Okay. You know, my mum had a lot of struggles. She's my biggest teacher and the most incredible woman, but had panic attack, agoraphobia, depression, you know, all of these things, and lived at an age where we didn't really seek treatment. There was a lot of shame. So it wasn't until I was 10 that she even knew what was happening and got support. So that was really big. And it was probably no surprise that I then ended up going on to develop anxiety and things myself. I had my first big panic attack when I was about 25. And at the time, I had just finished my counseling qualification. So I knew that I wanted to be in this space, and I knew I wanted to help people. And then I had a panic attack, and I felt like this massive imposter. And it took me quite a few years to come out of feeling like that and into feeling grateful for having gone through the struggles myself, because I've totally been there. So I had years of panic attacks. I had postnatal depression myself. I've had bouts of depression. I've had anxieties kind of being my little companion for the majority of my life. Mm-hmm. And so it was a journey of overcoming my own mental health stuff.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even through the initial tools that I learned in my training that I did that. It was having to find somatic work and nervous system regulation work that actually was that missing piece in overcoming the anxiety and the panic.
So sorry, just because some people's ears may have pricked up and I had written it down. Could you just kind of explain what somatic healing or somatic work is? Just because I know we'll touch on it a lot, so may as well help people out now.
Yeah, let's define that now.
Yeah.
So soma means body. So somatic just means working with the body. And I think that probably felt like, especially in New Zealand, but I think that's probably felt a little bit woo-woo for people for a while, doing body work.
A bit yogi, a bit like get a real job kind of stuff. Like, yeah, totally. I can hear it already.
And what does that even mean? And it's actually not at all woo-woo. And you're not getting up and doing some weird like dance tribal circle or anything when we do somatic work. What it actually means is we use tools that work at the level of the nervous system. So basically the nervous system doesn't speak English, like it doesn't speak a language. It speaks more in sensations. And we can work with that through movement, or even just through tapping into what is going on in the body, what is stuck there. And so when we've been through trauma or chronic stress, we can definitely do some amazing processing work for our mental health with talking and like with cognitive stuff, with our mindset. But there's often a missing piece to the puzzle. And you know what that feels like if you've done the mindset stuff, but you're still getting anxious, or you're still reactive and angry, or you're still getting triggered by things. And that's because stuff is stuck in the body. Implicit memories are stored in the unconscious. And so somatic work is just about working at this level of regulating the nervous system. So that's what the missing piece was for me and my mental stuff, for sure. So that's the journey into why I do this work. And Journey to Wellness was just this big, beautiful accident. Like, it was a complete accident how that came about.
Love that.
I'd been working with counseling at the time. People were I was finding people easily forget tools. They get dysregulated. They can't remember what to do between therapy sessions. So I started illustrating little tips and tricks and putting them on Instagram. And before I knew it, it blew up, and there was a book deal and all sorts of things. And I still don't understand what's happened.
I love that though. That's obviously, you know, when things are in flow. What was the first book, by the way? I was looking in the cover at all of them. I was curious what came first.
What came first was Note to Self. And that did really, really well, I think, to the shock of everyone involved in the book. And so then that sort of snowballed into let's do more books. And so this is my eighth book, this last one, and since 2020, which is ridiculous, actually, when I think about it, but really cool.
Ridiculous. It's so beautiful and perfect. Do each of them feel exciting in their own thing, or does it all feel kind of like
one giant book?
Yeah.
They all feel like, I call them like my book babies. They all feel like these little creations that you birth, because I'm involved with everything. Like, I write the whole thing, but also illustrate everything and heavily involved in design and everything. And I've said this new book, 101 Ways to Find Calm, is like, I feel like I have to whisper because my other books are nearby, but like, this is my favorite book baby. I love this one so much.
Beautiful. Yeah. Why do you think you like, is it because you feel more confident in the space, or is it that you've like tapped into this audience now that you know what they need? Is that kind of part of what it is?
I think so. And because I run this online membership, what I've realized is so many of the women that are coming in are saying, you know, I've done this work, but I just feel like maybe they've had trauma in their past, or they're just stuck in these patterns that keep showing up. And it seems to be that this nervous system work has been the missing piece, and they have these huge, big transformations through this work. So I'm so excited for this book to kind of be on mainstream shelves, showing what we can do when we work with the body. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, and just for anyone who hasn't picked it up yet, it's basically a bunch of practical tools. And I do think that's so helpful because, you know, and it is hard, especially even in this podcast space, is like every person is different, and things will strike chords with different people, and you can't, you know, paint everything with the same brush. But having a book of practical tools is so tangible and just delicious because you can be like, I don't want to sit with my legs up the wall. We'll flick to a different page and see what that might, which is really, really cool. I tapped on this at the beginning, but I'm curious about this desire to find calm. And this is from a selfish point of view as well. I do feel like a lot of life was chasing happiness and then learning kind of this happiness is a choice movement and it's an attitude adjustment. This idea of finding calm and just the resistance that so many of us, I'll put my hand up, have to feeling comfortable and calm as well. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Obviously, being this calm word is a big part of your identity and the work that you're doing. Why is it so important? And then why are people so resistant to the medicine that would probably help them?
Yeah, I'm actually almost going to completely contradict myself and the title of my book here, because I even said this to the publisher, like, I love this title, but, and the but is kind of like what you were talking about before, when we're constantly, if happiness is the goal, like that's really not useful thing, right? Because happiness is ever changing. It's not a destination. Same thing with finding calm. Like, it's impossible to just be a calm and regulated person all the time.
Yeah.
So I think in some ways it's like, it's almost just a catchy kind of attention drawing thing to say, let's find our calm. But underneath that, the layers that I actually teach are, I really don't want you to feel calm all the time, you know? Like, it's really super useful that we have different threat responses, that we feel all of the range of our feelings.
Mm.
And if we have a goal of, I just need to be like zen all the time and not ever feel heightened, I just want people to throw that out the window right now. So it's more so about, can we use this terminology like window of tolerance. So can we widen that? And which just means, can we have an ability to come back to feeling more regulated and calm, but also allow ourselves to shift out of that too when we need to, recognize that, and then have the tools to come back. So definitely people can kind of scrap the idea entirely of having to be calm all the time and that being the goal, just as we scrapped the happiness goal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you were like, not anymore. No, that's refreshing to hear, because I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast like me are kind of like high functioning depressives or high functioning anxiety, and are in that probably more at risk of burnout because of being in that constant fight or flight. So I think creating those moments of calm is probably what a lot of people listening just want, just little breaks of calm. And I think what sometimes we, I'll speak as a collective, met with is, in trying to find that calm, we actually create more anxiety. So that resistance of like meditation, where it's like, oh, now I've got a to-do list, now I'm in a panic, or in a yoga class, it's like, now I'm trapped here and there's so many things I have to do. So yes, as a professional, I wondered if you could kind of speak to that. And yeah.
Yeah, I'm nodding like furiously, because okay, yeah. 100% how I have been as well, that super high functioning anxiety. Yeah. Like, I think what it looked like for me a lot, and I seeing this in lots of people you might resonate, is you can be super on in your work. Like, you can come across as confident and bubbly and all of those things. You can be smashing through your work while you're at your 9 to 5. And then you come home and you're either irritable, or you park in the driveway and you just stare for like 5 minutes, can't even get out of the car. You come inside, you find yourself like doom scrolling. You are in sensory overload because the extractor fan's going. Mm-hmm. You just binge Netflix. You emotionally eat the whole block of chocolate. Like, so a lot of people are actually fluctuating between that high fight or flight, you know, that high functioning anxiety, but then flipping into like this functional freeze state, which is like a completely different place in the nervous system.
Yeah, this catatonic kind of thing, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But if you have got that high anxiety in the body, and also a lot of us in high functioning anxiety are really big intellectualizers. So it's like we cognitively know what we're doing and mindset stuff. And it's like, I know I should do X, Y, and Z, and I'm making meaning out of the things that happened in my past, and this is why I am this way. But no amount of intellectualizing shifts it. And that's the missing piece, is the nervous system work, because it's
felt. Ding, ding, ding. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And I did that too. I did it for years. I was like, I get it. Like, why is it still here? Why am I still showing up like this? Why am I still having this pattern in my relationships? Like, what's going on? But I wasn't doing that deeper unconscious work at the level of like stuck stuff.
Mm.
And so that's why so many of us, when we try to do certain practices, we A, are intellectualizing it, but B, if we're in that really high sympathetic, high anxiety, to-do lists, busy brain stuff, and then you try to come into what we think we should do, which is meditation or something still, it just feels awful. Yeah. And it doesn't work. And so we scrap all these practices, right? We just carry on this hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't work for a reason, and that's because it doesn't actually, it's not working with your nervous system when you do that. Like if you're anxious or angry and you try to just go immediately into a tool that brings you into calm, you're working with like the opposite energy of what anxiety is trying to do. So meditation sucks and our brains are full and all of that. You can get to that, but there's steps you've got to take before we can do that. And I think probably most people make that mistake.
Mm. What would be some examples of stomatic healing in terms of, is it these kind of practical tools like legs up the wall, sitting and grounding yourself? Is that what we would define as that kind of healing practice?
So some of the tools in the book are more like processing healing tools, okay. And some of them are more resources. So those types of ones are resources. Like that's a good thing to use when you need to go to your toolkit and pull something out that's going to help you regulate, or yep. You're dropping things into your day because you're trying to give your nervous system some sprinkles of love, like things that it loves, moments of grounding. So we've got to do resourcing. Resourcing is super useful if you're ever like triggered. So you've suddenly gotten really anxious or angry and I need something to bring this down, to get back into my body. You can use a resourcing tool. But the stuff that we do that actually processes stuck emotions or trauma or things like that is a little bit more nuanced and different. There's some tools in the book to do that. And a lot of that stuff is what I do in the membership because we've got kind of more space and time. It's quite hard to illustrate it in a book, but it's more about you might drop into your emotion for a moment. You might feel, where do I actually feel this in the body? So like, hello, kitty cat.
Yeah.
So, like when it's people pleasing, say you've gone into a pattern, you've just said yes to something and you wish you didn't. Instead of intellectualizing, making sense of why you did it, drop in and say, hang on, what's got my attention right now somatically? Oh, there's like a tightness in my throat. You might start to feel like a weight in the shoulders. So you sit with that and you watch that for a little while. You describe it, like how big is it? What shape is it? What color is it? You know, what texture, what temperature? Watching it, maybe breathing into it, seeing how it shifts, see if images come to mind, old memories come to mind. You might start having an impulse.
That's so interesting because I, as you said that, I'm like, that's exactly where my people pleasing is. It's like a choking kind of, yeah. Or like a big fiery ball. Is that common? Yeah. Is that kind of? Okay.
Yeah. And it shows up differently for everyone. Mine was this big black disc in my throat, like a little, like a
old CD. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Okay.
It's when you just talk about it like this at this cognitive layer, it sounds so silly and weird and bizarre. But when you actually drop in and feel into it, it's like, oh, wow, here it sits. And then often you find all these old links. And so there's some practices in there that you can pendulate, so move between it, feeling into something in the body, and then into a resource. And as you move back and forward, like grounding yourself, then feeling into it, it starts to shift it and to process it. So it's the book's kind of a combination of processing and resourcing tools. So they're kind of different.
Something that you posted, and I hope everyone, I'm sure they are already, but if they're not following you on Instagram, you posted something that gave me a few aha moments about trauma and how it shows up in your life on a reel you did recently, that trauma can show up as excessive spending, control, reading people's mood all the time. And yeah, I just wondered if you could speak to that, or maybe you have some more examples, because the control thing is a really interesting thing for me. And feel free to diagnose me or speak to this. And I know other people, I think it comes from a people pleasing or perhaps dealing with unpredictable family members. But I feel like I almost have a temperature gauge on everyone in a room at any point in time. And as soon as I see that getting like higher or lower for any, in my mind, reason, I feel like it's always my job to make sure that no one's, you know, either too high or too low, that it's upsetting the temperature of a room, which I understand is not my responsibility, but it's very difficult for me to not be hyper-focused and hyper-vigilant to that. And there is an element of control that I just want to make sure everyone's all good and fine at the time, which I'm assuming is probably a trauma response. I just, wondered if you could speak to either that specifically or how trauma is showing up. And then on top of that, what we need to do, like, is just being aware of it enough, or kind of what those next steps are?
Yeah, it's super interesting. Like, trauma shows up in the body in really interesting ways, and then it shows up in our behaviors. And sometimes they're totally unconscious. We don't even realize we're doing it. We've just always been like this. So, like, body-based things that might show up that could indicate some trauma, some stuff that is stuck in the body, is things like pain that was not explained medically. So if you've got back pain, tight hips, that blockage in the throat, that shoulder and neck pain, and if there's like dysfunctional breathing, so there's patterns of chest breathing, or if there's digestive issues or nausea that comes on suddenly out of nowhere, or brain fogs or headache, and cortisol shows up with like puffy face, a twitching eye, kind of all these random symptoms that we don't often think mean much, but can mean that the nervous system's kind of sending us these little nudges. And there's the behaviors, and it's exactly like what you were saying. Sometimes it's little sensory seeking things, like we're always fidgeting, picking, tucking our legs up on the seat. We're always swaying. And it can be exactly what you're saying there, is this doesn't even sound like a threat response, but overspending, or always craving salty, sugary snacks, or waking up between 3 and 5 a.m. every night, or the people pleasing or fawning is such a classic one to show up. And what you're saying there is, you kind of think, doesn't everyone just like read the room and kind of pick up on emotions and blah, but no, they don't. And I'm like total people pleaser in recovery myself, and fawn is one of my go-to things. And it pairs with some somatics. So like, it might pair with a throat closing, it might pair with the rushing tummy or the kind of closing in feeling that happens. But then it's does this person, are they anxious? Are they angry? Like, what's going on with that person? Or it's going out of your way to accommodate someone. If you're that person who's like running a social, like a kid's birthday party, or like throwing a little shindig for friends, and you're like, is it too hot in here? Is the lighting too bright? Are they all right? Oh, have they got a drink? Like, yes, you're being a good host, but are you also maybe fawning? And that's it's a really classic thing. And so, I mean, awareness is beautiful, and 100% the first step, as you said, like, what do we do when we recognize trauma or threat responses showing up? The awareness is a beautiful piece, as long as that comes with huge lashings of like compassion and grace. Like, okay, interesting. There's that again. I can witness that. Then we would do something that regulates the nervous system, even in that moment. So even at that event that you're at and you're starting to recognize things, you might simply like head to the bathroom and just come into like a little containment hug, squeeze down the boundaries of your body and just say, okay, Kim, like, you know, we're okay. We're safe. We're okay here in this moment. This is some old stuff, but we're safe with these people. And it isn't my job to look after them. And then you might do something that releases the throat block. So there's like some vagus nerve activation drills you can run. You can do this weird VU breath to unlock the throat vocal cord. So we can sort of pair it with some somatic practices in that moment, and bring in the cognitive stuff too, like challenging some of the beliefs that come up around people pleasing. So it's nuanced, and we want to do lots of things. And the other way of working with it is like a parts work perspective, where you notice that you have a people pleasing part, and you just get in like a little conversation with it, like, okay, you're showing up again. That's cool. I know you're trying to protect me. And where did you come from? And like, how old are you? Like, are you five? Is that when that started? And so if it's five, it is actually acting from a place of being 5 years old when it gets triggered. Mm-hmm. And then you can find out what are your needs and how can I like update your software to show you that I'm like this 30 something year old now who's totally capable and can do boundaries and it's safe to do that. But you're kind of like holding the hand of a 5 year old as you go through that.
That's quite a beautiful way of looking at it, like personifying it almost as self, because then you have a little bit more compassion for it. I think I sort of meet a bit of my people pleasing with frustration just because I feel like I ruin good moments by, like, an example might be in a room where I can tell someone is maybe not for me and I can feel that energy. And it's like, rather than the nine out of 10 that are like, awesome, I tend to like hyper-focus on trying to win that person over or to like really get to the bottom of what's going on. And I hyper-focus on that rather than the good, which is probably a little bit of negative self-talk. It's like, you know, they're telling the truth or whatever it might be. But it's, I think I meet a lot of that mindset with frustration because I do ruin good things or good moments by picking that to focus on. Does that make sense? So yeah, I don't treat it with grace and delight.
Totally resonating. I have exactly the two same parts that you're talking about. So your essential self is compassionate and has the ability to feel compassion for that. So you're now talking about two parts at war. So you've got your people pleaser part and the part of that's angry at that. And they both have a place and you can talk with them both as well. So the people pleases like doing everything she can because she's had to in the past for survival. She's had to please and appease. She had to fawn. But the frustration part is like, oh, for God's sake, you know, we don't have to do this anymore. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and kind of get a bit of a backbone. I think I do feel in that duality of like, it's okay to stand up for yourself or say no. Like, but I self-abandon in those moments and kind of just focus on that, which is such an interesting. And I share this because I know other people do it too. It's just a hard thing to kind of.
Oh, it is. And you can have people, you can, and anyone listening, and I've had to do this, is have conversations with both of those parts. Have a conversation with this probably quite young part that is just desperate to try to be accepted because that's attachment and survival. That's why we people please. We have to survive. We want to fit in. It makes sense. So we can like wrap that with love and give it a new job. Actually, what you're doing is just making sure that we're okay with others. And that's awesome. You're looking after our relationships, but we can do that differently. And then turn to this frustrated part that's like, get a backbone and be like, oh, you're amazing. So you're coming in hot with boundaries and like fire in your belly to protect us. Let's use some of that energy, but not in a way that attacks a part of ourself, you know? So you get to have this cool dialogue with these two parts of you.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you're right. Because I end up just hurting myself. And it's like, this could have been a great day. Like, you know what I mean?
Like, it happened.
Yeah, totally. And then just by my own design, I feel. And then that other part comes in, the guilt and shame that it's like, we've done so much work and we shouldn't. It's my words I'm not supposed to say.
Yourself.
Yeah, totally. But it is exhausting at times, I think, as well. And which is why I was really excited about your book, especially those practical tools. I think I have a resistance to it just because it will probably help me. And so it's my own thing. So I'm really excited about that. Time has been sucked away in talking to you. I'm not sure where that went, but there is a question I'd love to ask you. And I ask all my guests about what does your brain look like, Rebecca? If you were up there and it's either a beautiful picture or a chaotic hamster wheel or whatever, what do you kind of see when you think of your brain?
I see two different things. This is like two parts of myself. One is, have you heard that ridiculous thing where it's like, I've got 50 computer tabs open and I can't figure out where the music is coming from?
Oh my God, yes. Okay. Yep. Got it.
Sometimes my brain's like that. It's easy to get into that real high sympathetic energy and like creative as well. And I've just got 100 tabs open at once.
Yep.
I recognize that. And then I realize I've got to stop it and drop into my body. And so that's where the other part of my brain does look like my safe place, which I created, which is just a little garden with a little stream running through it and little wildflowers. And I go there when I need to. Another little somatic tool people can use is just creating a little safe haven that they can go to. And so part of my brain is quite nice.
My gosh, I love that, because I think it also, it shows the duality that we can be both and we can live in both. But out of curiosity, is your garden with a stream something you've actually seen before, or did you create it fictionally?
I fully created it fictionally so that it was not tied to anything in my life that may have had trauma in it, or that may be linked to a person that would trigger off a different thought space for me. Wow. So when I create safe spaces, I make them fictional. So my other one is like an armchair by a roaring fire and having hot chocolate. And I've never been there, but it makes me feel really calm. So it's a really good one if you've had, like, if you get triggered, is create safe spaces and look for glimmers as well that remind you of your safe spaces. So I also embed comfort colors. So each safe space has a color that I embed in it, or symbols embedded, and then you see them in real life and it reminds you of like the glimmers. So it might be that I try to embed a color green or a color mustard, and then when I see it, it's like, oh, there's my little safe color. And it reminds you just like breath, where there is safety around you regardless of how hypervigilant you are. So yeah, it's lovely.
Beautiful. And then lastly, if you do have 2 seconds, just because I think it would be a miss if I didn't touch on this, because I do think you have the vocabulary to answer this. You mentioned earlier about sort of just your upbringing and your environment. I wonder if you could offer a tip or a tool or a do or a don't for anyone who is perhaps in relationship or in family with someone who perhaps is in a journey with mental health. So perhaps it isn't them themselves, but they're trying to be a support person, or they're living with it. Because I understand my biggest fear of, you know, my journey with depression and anxiety has been not to be burdensome, yet asking for help is what I need to do and stuff. And it's also been interesting being a bystander to people when they're dealing with grief or other mental illnesses or diagnoses. And I just wondered, as someone who is mentioned that you grew up in that environment, if there was anything you could offer our listeners that are perhaps do's and don'ts of being a support person to someone, any words of compassion to that?
That's such a lovely question. I think it comes down to, do focus on what is within your control in that. So that's probably showing up in non-judgment, in grace, in compassion. It's telling them that you're there for them. And it's also, the don'ts is also the don't focus on what you can't control. So ultimately, it's their journey. And just like when someone gives us unsolicited advice that we're not ready for, we won't take it. Mm. We can't also force someone along a faster journey or along the route that we think they should be on, because that maybe worked for us. So they may have a different path to get there. And that's really hard sometimes, to sit back and kind of watch this person navigate. So we can keep showing up with that grace and compassion, keep saying, I've got some tools. Do you want them? Here's what I can offer you. But then being able to step back and say, and now it's up to them what they take and what they don't. And I can't control their behavior and their emotions. And in supporting someone else, we also have to massively support ourselves. So if anyone's in the thick of it with someone, that can be, there's so much blurring that can happen there, and so much like emotional absorption, and we can end up carrying quite a lot of it ourselves. So what are you doing for yourself too, that you kind of creating like a safety barrier for you, or letting go of some of that energy and kind of nourishing and filling up your own cup in that? Because it's tiring too when you're around people who are struggling, and it's okay that you feel tired or you feel compassion fatigue or all of that. So just keep coming back to that faith, love, compassion piece. It's very possible to get through it. Sometimes people do need you to give them some tools, and if you're in the space to do that, then do so.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's always nice to to also acknowledge there are a lot of people doing a lot of research, listening to podcasts like this, not for themselves, but for others too, which is really beautiful. So there's a lot of people listening. Thank you. Sorry I went over my allocated time. It's been so nice chatting to you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
It's been amazing to chat to you. Thank you for having me.